the door and turn the lights down low. Put some music on, it's soft and slow. Baby, we ain't got no place to go. I hope you understand. I've been thinking about this all day long. Never felt a feeling quite this strong. I can't believe how much it turns me on just to be your man.
There's no hurry, don't you worry. We can take our time. Come a little closer, let's go over what I had in mind.
Baby, lock the door and turn the lights down low. Put some music on that's soft and slow. Baby, we ain't got no place to go. I hope you understand. I've been thinking about this all day long. Never felt a feeling quite this strong.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome back. I am Mel Simpson. I would have hopefully seen everyone here yesterday. I am from McCullough Robertson Lawyers. I'm going to be chairing today's session. Today's session is an update from the ATO in relation to the R&D space in the agribusiness space following recent court cases and also the taxpayer alerts that were published last year. Presenting today is Brett Zimmerman from the ATO and Ellen Lau. So Brett is an assistant commissioner and Ellen is a senior auditor. And they do ask to hold questions and they will answer those at the end. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I'm taking my phone here because I do have a tendency to rabbit on and lose time. So if just yawn if I keep going too long. Ellen and I have broken up today's discussion with myself focusing on more technical matters. And Ellen will be focusing more on some of those more practical compliance R&D aspects that are always useful for everyone to remember and be attentive to, particularly ahead of not only advising clients in relation to R&D matters generally, but ahead of them completing their tax returns. Now, I do have a buzzer here. Now, I also have tried to get a feel for people's level of R&D understanding during sort of the morning tea and lunch and cocktail function events. And I'm getting a sense that for some of you, you know, R&D is not something you do every day. And so what I intend to do in my sort of technical discussion is not to assume a great deal, and perhaps where necessary, give a bit of an R&D 101 for you. Now, in terms of the stuff that I'll be talking to, it is really those cases and technical matters. These litigation cases, I was personally the assistant commissioner, sort of with responsibility for them, and also in terms of the taxpayer alerts and the decision impact statement for GQHC that was only published last week, Friday. I too sort of had a significant role in its drafting and sign off. So I do encourage you, if you do have any questions, whether in the room or for the cast of thousands watching, that you do take advantage and either speak at the end of this session or during the lunch break. All right. So let's perhaps start with probably the most topical R&D case for the office since the introduction of the tax offset. And this is the matter of GQHC. So, but actually, I'm jumping ahead of myself. This is what I'll be talking to. And before doing that, I just want to give that 101. All right. Please forgive me this if you all know this already. we have an R&D tax offset regime. Prior to having an R&D tax offset, we had an R&D tax concession. And an R&D tax concession prior to about 2012 was giving R&D entities an increased deduction for their eligible R&D expenditure. In about 2012, we moved to an offset. So you'll hear me talk of things like notional deductions. And when an entity is entitled to a notional deduction, they're entitled to an offset equal to a particular percentage of that total notional deduction amount. Now, not everyone's entitled to an R&D tax offset. You need to be an R&D entity. And an R&D entity is limited to companies or body corporates. Now, this is particularly relevant when we discuss the Sunlight full federal court case. So if you're a discretionary trust, you're not entitled to a notional deduction. So, you know, it does pose for some corporate group structures interesting questions that they need to ask themselves as to whether they seek to obtain the offset or not. Now, on the assumption you have an R&D entity, in order to have a tax offset, you need to have incurred expenditure on eligible R&D activities. The expression R&D activities is defined in Division 355. From memory, it's 355-25, and that was of significant discussion in GQHC, which I'll get to. But it also needs to be incurred on those activities. So that we often refer to as the nexus issue. So there needs to be a proper connection between the incurring of the expense and also the activity. If you're incurring expenditure to an associate, you don't just get a notional deduction at the time you incurred that expense. You need to have paid that amount. So that was an issue with the XQDX case, which we'll be talking to, and also it's noted as being of significance when we talk to some of the taxpayer alerts. Some other basic things I do want to draw attention to with how the R&D regime works is that it's a dual administration program. Some of you may have heard of Oz Industry, or I think they prefer to call themselves DISA at the moment, although I think I always have to check before sending them a communication as to what they presently call themselves. So if I switch between DISA or Oz Industry, just assume I'm talking about the same entity. Now, in order to be entitled to a notional deduction and a tax offset, the R&D entity needs to register with Oz Industry the activities that they are conducting. That's a statutory prerequisite of entitlement. So if you don't have registration with Oz Industry, you just can't get an offset. Now, Oz Industry also have a review function. So when an entity registers with Oz Industry their activities, Oz Industry can either themselves choose to review those activities as to whether or not they are eligible within the meaning of Section 355-25 in the case of core R&D, or 355-30 in the case of supporting R&D activities. Or, alternatively, that the R&D entity itself might want Oz Industry to review it, akin to, say, a private ruling application were you to ask the commissioner. So you can ask for an advance finding from Oz Industry as to whether or not your activities meet those legislative requirements. Or thirdly, the commissioner himself can request Oz Industry to commence an examination and for a finding to be made. So that's in circumstances where the commissioner has, as part of an ATO audit or review, looked at a taxpayer's expenditure and activities and goes, I'm not too sure if these activities as registered meet the definition of core R&D. I'm going to refer this matter to my co-administrator and ask them to review those activities, and they will make a finding. And as we can talk about in later slides, that finding is binding on us. And that aspect of the dual administration was also considered and discussed at length in the GQHC litigation, which followed the Octus Resources full federal court decision a few years prior to that. And, you know, it is that aspect of GQHC that has been subject to some commentary amongst practitioners, and indeed whether or not what the Commissioner's course of action in GQHC was indeed within his power to do so. So pretty much that's how R&D works. You incur expenditure on R&D activities. If it's eligible, you get an offset. There are some integrity provisions there that require the R&D activities to be incurred for the benefit of the entity claiming, et cetera, and we will get on to that. But I thought maybe now just to jump to GQHC. Now, there is a bit of history to this case, and this graphic here that you see I've put onto the slide is actually in the judgment itself. So I know each of you are very keen to read all 229 pages of that judgment on conclusion of this session. But this matter, just to maybe give you a bit of history about me, I've not always been in the ATO. I was a commercial and tax law solicitor for about 19 years before I was invited to essentially apply and join the ATO as an assistant commissioner in 2019. I was in the office for about 2 weeks before I was allocated this GQHC matter. So GQHC was a matter that the applicant sought review from the Administrative Appeals Tribunal in March 2019. We got judgment in this matter on, was it the 16th of February, 2024? So we're almost talking exactly 5 years. So, but we had the pandemic, you know, that impacted finding a sufficient judicial window for the matter to be heard. And there was also, this was around the time when the Administrative Appeals Tribunal was turning into, what is it, the ART now. So there are reasons for why there was a delay. Now, this matter, to give you some of the history, began life as solely a feedstock case. Now, to give you some understanding of how the feedstock provisions work in the R&D rules, essentially, if an R&D entity has claimed an R&D tax offset for expenditure it has incurred in acquiring or producing a good or material that has been transformed or processed during R&D activities into a marketable, tangible product or a feedstock output, as the legislation describes it, and that marketable feedstock output is either sold to market or applied to the entity's own use, then there is a clawback of the offset that was claimed on those feedstock inputs. So in the context of GQHC, we had a poultry producer that had claimed R&D expenditure in part on the chicken feed that it was feeding to its broiler layers, as well as the cute fluffy little chick, and that after a period of time grows to be a fully mature bird for processing. And so the applicant in this case had self-assessed in their returns that the chicken feed that was fed to their birds was a feedstock input, because you feed chickens an amount of food, it breaks down that food, that breaking it down converts to, you know, breast meat and others, and the large chicken is then sold. So the taxpayer had themselves self-assessed that the feedstock provisions applied. Very soon before the expiry of the applicant's period of review, they lodged an objection to their own assessment. So we call that a self-objection. They lodged a self-objection trying or asserting that there ought not to have been a feedstock adjustment. So essentially, the feed that is fed to livestock for the purposes of the R&D feedstock provisions is not transformed or processed into the marketable product. That was the argument of the applicant. The commissioner disallowed that objection, and so the taxpayer filed with the tribunal their application for review. At this point of the matter, the commissioner had not raised any other concerns with the applicant's R&D claim. This was not a matter that began at audit or, you know, wasn't a traditional objection in the sense that you're probably familiar with objections. This was a self-objection on this specific feedstock question. But before the AAT, it's a de novo decision, and so the commissioner, when defending its assessment, is not limited to, for example, just that feedstock issue. So when the matter was first discussed at some directions hearing and the like, it became apparent to both parties that we would be putting the eligibility of the taxpayer's actual R&D activities in dispute. The commissioner himself felt that the registered activities of GQHC did not satisfy the definition to be core R&D. And for those who don't know or those who want a reminder, to be a core R&D activity, it needs to be an experimental activity whose outcome is unknown or incapable of being known in advance, that proceeds from hypothesis through to experiment evaluation and the like. We felt that it didn't meet that definition, and so that was also in dispute. Now, because this was the first matter where the commissioner had himself actively made that a part of his defence, the applicants questioned our jurisdiction to do so. A few moments ago, I noted to you that we have a dual administration. And traditionally, in addition to Oz Industry or DISA's registration role, they have a review role. So, you know, either the commissioner himself can request a review or the DISA or Oz Industry can themselves, you know, as part of a normal random audit process review. So the applicants question our ability to put that in dispute. So there were essentially three issues here. A feedstock issue about, is chicken feed that is fed to a fluffy chick or any form of livestock really transformed or processed into a larger output, because we recognise that's a big deal in this agribusiness space, okay? The second issue was this jurisdictional point about whether or not the commissioner indeed can make an assertion as to the ineligibility and put a taxpayer to proof on the point. And if we do have that power, as a question of fact, has this poultry producer satisfied those requirements to be to be conducting eligible R&D activities? Some points you can just see on this slide. The applicants chose not to file a federal court appeal. So the matter of GQHC is it in terms of its present authority, unless a future taxpayer wishes to dispute the constructional positions of GQHC in another case this case is it. And we did, I noted earlier, publish a decision impact statement last week, Friday. All right, I think I've pretty much covered this slide already in my enthusiasm to talk. Essentially, this is this feedstock issue, and ultimately what the tribunal held was the feedstock provisions are not to be narrowly construed, and they can apply as equally to agricultural businesses as they can to mining or construction or manufacturing enterprises. And so this concept of transformation and processing extends to, you know, more natural forms of processing without almost an external agent being applied. That was one of the applicants' contentions, and you will see this in the 229 pages. I'm certainly not telling any tales out of school here. So it came down to a question of digestion. You know, I remember saying to my young kids, eat your vegetables because you'll grow up to be big and strong, okay? You know, when you feed chicken feed, you know, and you they grow up to be big and strong birds, does that fall within the statutory definition? And the senior member, Greg, certainly confirmed that. Now, I'm probably going to hazard a guess here and say almost all of you will go, I didn't think that was even an issue. I would have just assumed that, you know, you feed something that it just transformed or processed into, you know, that's why you feed it. You know, you know, 10 biology says that a portion of what you eat, you know, goes to keeping your heart beating, goes to improving your immune system, but also goes to your growth, and then some, the byproduct, comes out as waste. But we have been aware of some R&D advisors having this view that the feedstock application, sorry, the feedstock rules do not apply in the manner as found by the tribunal. So hence why there was some strategic significance in us running this case. So on the facts, the tribunal concluded that yes, the feed fed to day-old broiler chickens and to broiler breeders was indeed transformed or processed. Another point that the tribunal made, sort of almost in its second to last paragraph, if you're a bit like me, having read Harry Potter, and you jumped straight to the back page and found that Snape did indeed kill Dumbledore. If you jump to the very end of GQ8C, the tribunal has also confirmed that if the feedstock input is transformed or processed into the feedstock output, you know, it's not a suggestion of having to apportion how much of that feedstock input is actually gone into the output. So I mentioned to you before in my silly example, not silly, you know, you feed an animal something, some goes to keeping the heart beating, some goes to its physical growth, and some you excrete, right? The tribunal said, look, no. If it's a feedstock input that goes into the transformational processing of the feedstock output, you know, don't do any further apportionment there. Some other just quick points there, noting obviously time is always of the essence. We have an existing tax ruling 2013/3 on the feedstock provisions. As an office, we are presently reviewing whether or not we ought to update that ruling to reflect some of the tribunal's insightful comments in its decision. Some of you who have familiarity with R&D and feedstock might be aware of the GHP decision of 2014, I think GHP was. The tribunal did note that GHP didn't provide any assistance in interpreting the words transformed or processed during R&D activities. I won't really talk any more about GHP given the time, but that might be another reason we consider having to just update the ruling. All right. Moving on to this jurisdictional point, I've already given at length the historical context to this. This was a case where we felt it was appropriate for us to put eligibility in dispute. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why we did that. When the commissioner... Sorry, I'll go back a step. Pause, rewind. When a taxpayer registers with Oz Industry Dyser, they have self-assessed their eligibility of activities. Now, that self-assessment is not conclusive evidence of it being so eligible, and that's why we have, you know, Oz Industry or the courts and now potentially the commissioner himself having the ability to put it in dispute. But we, as a matter of practice, have always sought to refer matters of concern to Oz Industry. And when Oz Industry make a finding, that finding is binding on the commissioner, with one important caveat. And that caveat is that the finding is made within 4 years of the end of the relevant income year. So I'm going to paint some of these facts in a little bit more detail. GQHC was a matter that concerned the FY 2013. So they were a 30 June lodger. So for a finding to be binding on the commissioner as to eligibility, Oz Industry would need to have made that finding by the 30th of June 2018. Okay, no, 2017, right? Yet the taxpayer only filed their self-objection, as you will see in the facts, you know, after that date. So it was not open in any practical or legally binding sense for the commissioner to refer it to our co-administrator for them to do a review. So before the tribunal, in a practical sense, the commissioner has to make a call as to whether or not he will accept the registration indeed as conclusive evidence of the eligibility. And in this case, it was felt, given the activities, and I'll touch upon them soon, it wasn't appropriate. So the tribunal confirmed indeed that the commissioner can, absent a binding finding himself when considering if expenditure is incurred on R&D activities, to consider the eligibility. All right. Now, we've got GQHC. Now, the commissioner is not going to be starting some random audit process to review the eligibility of R&D entities' registered activities. Okay? There's going to be no change in the commissioner's approach, and that is that, you know, when, as part of our ordinary compliance work, we identify activities of concern, we will continue to escalate that to Oz Industry. However, when it's not practical or possible for Dyser to examine an R&D activities, then, you know, we might, in the right circumstance, make that decision, okay? And also, as part of this decision, you know, we were always, you know, considering whether or not it indeed was that appropriate case. And perhaps when we talk about some of the activities that will hopefully come out, why I am mindful of time, so I've got to keep going forward. But I just want to say, we are aware that the Commissioner's position in putting eligibility in dispute has raised some eyebrows. And there's been suggestion, and I'm going to quote this. This is from an article I read recently, that this is the Commissioner looking to expand his powers. This is not the Commissioner looking to expand his powers. This is the Commissioner in the context of a litigation case when faced with whether or not to accept as fact the eligibility of a registered activity or just putting it to the taxpayer to convince the tribunal as to that eligibility. We took the latter course of action. All right, now on the facts, the activities were not eligible. There was an incubation hatchery project, there was a water quality project, there was a shed cleaning project, and there was a broiler improvement project. A simple example, the broiler improvement project, and I'm grossly simplifying this, partially involved this poultry producer conducting purported R&D in determining what is the most efficient form of feed for its chicken. If I feed chickens corn versus sorghum versus wheat versus whole grain sorghum versus whole wheat, etc., is that eligible R&D? And the tribunal concluded that no, it was not. Now, there are some interesting observations there that the tribunal made, and they are on the slide there. I know you have them. And one of the points I want to point to this audience, okay, because I know it's an agribusiness audience, is it was argued before the tribunal that if the Commissioner's view as to eligibility was to be taken to its extreme, it would only be open for universities and other research institutions who would qualify. The tribunal dismissed that, saying, look, that's not the case. You know, it can apply and does apply to private industry, but there still needs to be a baseline threshold supported by the basic principles of established science. So I might just move on there to something wholly non-GQHC related. And this is in relation to an issue which we see a little bit of, which is payments to associates. So there are a number of issues that we see, and these are touched upon in the two taxpayer alerts that we published in December. Essentially, under the R&D provisions, an entity can indeed incur expenditure to an associate, but there are a number of things which we are seeing that entities sometimes get wrong or try and exploit. In order for an R&D entity to claim an R&D offset for expenditure it incurs to its associate, first of all, it needs to be incurred, right? It seems a bit of a no-brainer, but that entities sometimes get that wrong. Secondly, when the expenditure is to an associate, your timing of your notional deduction offset is in the income year in which it is paid. So as you'll see from XQDX, which will come in the next slide or two, that was a situation where the R&D entity had a purported liability or a purported expense to its associate entity, and it was just increasing a loan account, you know. So it wasn't actually paying that amount. It was saying, oh, look, I've paid it because I've reflected it in my accounts. And so, you know, the courts will say that the mere entry into your financials doesn't of itself constitute constructive payment. One of the other points here, and it's the third bullet point I have here, and I'll for an R&D entity to be entitled to a notional deduction for its R&D expenditure, again, it's a bit of a no-brainer. It needs to have conducted those R&D activities for itself, right? So I can't be conducting R&D for a friend, right? I've got to conduct it for myself. So the fruits of my R&D have got to be to my benefit. Now, that doesn't mean to say that another entity can't benefit from that R&D, but the provisions have a requirement that says if there is another entity for which the R&D's activities are conducted to a significant extent for, then again, you're not entitled to a notional deduction. It's not an apportionment. You don't say, well, I did this R&D activity and, yeah, I received a 30% benefit and another entity received a 70% benefit. Now, look, those of you who know R&D, there are things like R&D partnerships and the like, but I'm not going to go there. So essentially, when you have payments to associates, these are the types of issues that we are seeing. Now, I've made a point here in my notes to stress. The Commissioner is not suggesting at all that you should not use associates as part of the conducting of your R&D activities. What we're saying in the case that follows and some of the other discussion will just reflect that the arrangements need to be bona fide, they've got to be documented, and sometimes an entity's got to choose as to really who is this R&D activity for. And if at the end of the day it's not for the corporate entity, then maybe it just needs to accept it might not be entitled to a notional deduction. So this is the case of XQDX. I thought by putting a bit of a visual diagram there, it might help explain the facts a little bit. So this was not in the agribusiness space, but I can see these facts as very much applying to agribusiness. This is where a discretionary trust has historically been conducting a business. The discretionary trust sought to take advantage. And I would say, when I use the words take advantage, I don't mean exploit or in a negative sense. You know, they wanted to, they had heard about the R&D tax offset. So they knew that a company is the entity type that's entitled. You know, if you're a discretionary trust, you're not entitled to a notional deduction. So they had an arrangement with this company. It was very, if I said lightly documented, I think that's, you know, giving them a huge, you know, significant benefit. Now, I think it was zero documentation. But essentially, this was where XQDX company itself was purporting to be conducting R&D activities for itself. It's got no employees. It's got no bank account of its own. And what it's doing is it's contracting, and again, I use the word contracting because there was no, I don't believe, service agreement, right? With the trust to provide all those services, right? The court ultimately, or the tribunal, sorry, Deputy President Boyle said, look, you haven't even incurred the expense, right? Because the liability that was owed between the company and the trust was one that there were two basic contingencies to repayment. One was you only have to repay this loan if ever you get an R&D offset, right? Which sort of hints at a little bit of, you know, questions. And the second was, if the R&D that we conduct has value and it is sold, then we'll repay you. But in those circumstances, you know, don't worry. I'm being a little bit flippant with my language. It was certainly not said as such in the decision. And the tribunal held that there was no definitive obligation to pay, okay? So it wasn't incurred, and consequently, the tribunal didn't really have to decide all those other issues like, was it even paid? Although, as I noted to you, mere entry into the financials doesn't constitute constructive payment. We didn't even have to, or the tribunal didn't even have to say to whom the entity was for. Now, I am mindful of time, and Ellen, you need to do some talking. So I'm going to jump through, and maybe I'm just going to limit our discussion to some of these cases again. Sunlight. Sunlight is XQDX by another name. So again, you probably all know, when a matter is before the tribunal, a taxpayer under our Tax Administration Act is able to request confidentiality and have their identity essentially suppressed. Okay? So before the tribunal, Sunlight wanted that, and so that was why the matter was referred to as XQDX. The moment a tribunal, a taxpayer chooses to further appeal a matter to the federal court, then suddenly you get an identity to the entity you're talking about. So to go back to GQHC, that will remain as GQHC, and the judgment is certainly written in a manner, hopefully, that the identity of the taxpayer remains confidential. So Sunlight was not a case that actually considered R&D issues. One of the curious arguments that the taxpayer ran in this case was, I'm just going to go back a step. I had these as two different entities side by side. What I didn't tell you was XQDX Co. was actually the trustee company of the trust, right? So it was, you know, they didn't even bother to incorporate a new company. Oh, what did I do? Oh, phew. All right. So what we had here was the company saying, well, look, we hear what you say, tribunal, but at law, it is still the corporate entity as a legal person that is conducting the R&D activities and that is incurring the expense. The fact that it, as trustee, has a right of indemnity against the trust's assets doesn't diminish the fact that it's still a corporate entity that has conducted it. I think when we got the notice of appeal, I may have sort of, you know, if I was drinking a cup of coffee, it would have gone over my desk, because I felt like saying, you do realise there's a Division 960 in our Income Tax Assessment Act that recognises that a trustee company can have multiple capacities. And so this matter was brought before the full federal court. You know, so we skipped a single judge. So essentially we went to Perth. We had senior counsel Chloe Burnett acting for ourselves, supported by Anthony Willinge, and it was listed for 2 days. Written submissions were provided. Justice Colvin was probably the lead of the three judges on the bench. After 1 hour of a two-day hearing, Justice Colvin asked the senior counsel for the applicant, saying, are you okay if we take a recess, please? So he and Justice Futrell and Justice O'Sullivan came back and basically said, we've heard all we needed to say. Thanks for coming. Decision will be handed down shortly. And I think we've got a judge in about 3 weeks to confirm indeed that when the R&D provisions talk about trustees in, you know, as a body corporate, it means it acting in that capacity. All right. I am just now going to note, we got this taxpayer alert. Essentially, the contents I've already hinted at already. And like I said, my messaging is not a thou shalt not use associate entities in the conducting of your R&D activities. The very R&D provisions recognise the use of associates, right? That's why they have the paid requirement. And that's why they say, look, if you're incurring expenditure to an associate, it needs to be at market value. So there's essentially a market value substitution rule there. So be mindful that that is there. And there's a related entity, sorry, a related alert, which deals with essentially associate expenditure to overseas entities. But because in this agribusiness patch, I'm probably unfamiliar to the extent that you guys would be conducting R&D activities overseas. I don't really need to say any more than that. TDS Biz was a federal court case that we had halfway through last year. Essentially, we had an Australian resident company conducting R&D activities, and it was entitled to its R&D expenditure on its expenditure conducted on what I'll call domestic Australian R&D work. The R&D provisions have requirements that say if a portion of your R&D activities are being conducted overseas, then you need to get from Oz Industry an overseas finding. And if you don't have an overseas finding, it's just a binary. You're buggered or you're not buggered, right? And in this case, they were buggered because whether they had forgotten, I don't know, or they didn't think it was required for some reason, they never had an overseas finding. And so the expenditure incurred on the conducting of their overseas activities was not entitled to a notional deduction. But I do believe they got their notional deduction for their domestic expenditure. Now, one of the points I just want to make here as well, before perhaps just going to one more slide, if that's okay. But on this is, there's obviously a difference between conducting R&D activities overseas and what I'll call the mere supply of parts. So in TDS Biz, both the tribunal and the federal court recognised, look, this was more than just a supply of parts. So a silly example, and I certainly hope you don't quote me on this, but I see I'm being recorded, is, look, if as part of my R&D activities, I put an order in at Bunnings, right? I need a couple of screws, right? And I just get, that's a supply of parts, right? Whereas if I arrange with an overseas entity and ask them to create a bespoke product, and I've given them, you know, there's some prefabrication required and all that sort of stuff, it goes beyond the mere supply of parts. And in TDS Biz, that was the case. Now, I'm just going to jump ahead to this, which is my final slide. Boggiato. It's not a new case, but it's a case I often hear mentioned. People using Boggiato as a, oh, look, Boggiato is a case that says essentially the burden of proof is on the commissioner to assert you're not entitled to a notional deduction. But what I think those who perhaps are saying it don't appreciate, or they're choosing not to say, is that Boggiato was a promoter penalty case. Promoter penalties, I think we all know, are those provisions that allow the commissioner to ask the federal court to impose a penalty on promoters of tax exploitation schemes. In such a case, the burden of proof is indeed on the commissioner. So the commissioner has to prove, you know, to the standard required by the federal court, that the not only is the particular person a promoter and that they've received consideration, but the scheme benefit was not reasonably arguable, right? That is wholly distinguishable from normal Part 4C matters where the burden of proof is on the commissioner. Now, the final bullet I wanted to say here, and I do again apologise, is there are what I'll call bad actors in the R&D space. You've probably, maybe as part of your own practices, seen the snake oil salesman and the like. You know, have I got a deal for you? We've got a contingency fee arrangement here, right? Where you don't pay me anything until such time as I'm able to confirm for you or lodge. So, and I'm exaggerating there for, you know, largely dramatic effect. But always be cautious as practitioners in whose advice you receive. You know, R&D consultants are not always tax agents, right? and R&D consultants, that our tax agents themselves might be a little bit aggressive in how they advise. So one of the messages I just want to leave with you guys is always be careful and do your due diligence, because, you know, if I go back to GQHC as my final note, there was no suggestion in the office or held by me personally that this entity was trying to do anything wrong, right? They were a poultry producer. They know a lot about, you know, growing chickens, okay? They don't know a lot about R&D. And they found themselves in a litigation dispute that extended to 5 years almost. And, you know, because they had, you know, the basis of their claim was that, you know, the chicken feed was not transformed or processed. So anyway, on that note, I'm just going to hand to Ellen and apologise once more.
Thank you, Brett. And I'm just going to go through the last few slides and just talk about more of the practical and administrative matters regarding R&D. So the R&D tax transparency report, this measure was announced in the 2020-2021 budget, the aim of which was to publish information and improve public accountability and encourage voluntary compliance within the R&D program. So what happens is that the ATO is required to publish R&D expenditure claimed by an R&D entity 2 years after the end of the financial year. So this year we are publishing our first report. It'll be around September, we think, September 2024, and it'll relate to the 2022 financial year. So importantly, R&D entities cannot opt out of reporting of the report. And the information we will publish comes from the forms that you guys lodge, the R&D entity lodges. It will include the R&D entity name, their ABN or ACN, and the total R&D expenditure claimed. It's got the little formula there. So where it will be published will be on the data.gov.au website. And additionally, the ATO will do a contextual analysis document, which just basically has some key insights, industry trends and things like that. And that will be published actually on the ato.gov.au website. So I'll talk about some record keeping. So Brett's given us some really good background technical matters, but in practice, what do we need to do as an R&D entity to justify our claims? So over the past 5 or 10 years, the ATO has had a really big push on tax governance. So just a really simple example of a tax governance document for R&D, maybe just a policy or procedure outlining how the taxpayer will prepare, review, sign off the R&D tax incentive registration, or how they will prepare and review their tax offset. So the benefits of the tax governance would be for them showing effective tax risk management and control to the stakeholders. It might assist them in obtaining finance, and in the event of a review or audit, it'll just basically justify their claim, substantiate their claim. So as Brett has already mentioned, the ATO is responsible for determining the availability of the tax offset, but DISA is responsible for the registrations and looking at eligibility. So despite that, the ATO will still look at records prepared on the R&D activities to determine whether the expenditure claimed is incurred on the eligible R&D activities as registered. So to that end, the companies need to distinguish between eligible R&D activities and ineligible activities, such as ordinary business activities. So while the exact records each business might differ, will differ, ultimately, what you really want to show is the expenditure, the activity, and how they relate. So, you know, you might have employees that are specifically allocated to R&D activities, and they may be the people that document the core eligible activities. So they might keep documents relating to the experiments, the hypothesis, the results, the dates that they worked on these projects or these activities. And, you know, if the experiment goes into a different direction, you know, document when that happened and so forth. So you've got the employees who are responsible for the experiments, and then you've probably got a different set of people possibly responsible for putting accounts together and putting the claim together. And really, they should be communicating and making sure that as a person who does the R&D activity, you know what records you need to keep to help the person doing the claim, that to help them substantiate the claim. And conversely, the person doing the claim needs to understand what the R&D activity is so that they can know, oh, okay, well, this expenditure is incurred on that and that isn't. So really, you really need to have some good communication between the, everybody involved in the R&D activities if you want to claim those notional deductions. And as mentioned before, you need to keep your records of the R&D activity. You also need to, if possible, show that the R&D activities are carried out for the purpose of generating new knowledge, the outcome of which can't be known in advance. So these are probably just documentary things you might keep relating to, you know, what was the state of affairs before you started these experiments? What were you trying to achieve? How you couldn't determine the result in advance. So, you know, what research did you do to see if other people had done similar experiments or something like that? So, again, those things are probably documented in your project planning documents, your registration documents that you lodge, and maybe like industry articles and things like that. So the records you keep should be kept contemporaneously. So as Brett mentioned before, don't try to go back 2-3 years when you want to lodge a return and try to say, oh, okay, well, I spent 1 to 2 days or somebody spent 1 to 2 days a week on this. Try to keep those documents as you go so that there's no dispute later on and no guessing of your claim. I was going to read. I won't read. No. Okay. So again, records to show you received the major benefit from the R&D activities. If you're entering into contracts with associates for services and stuff like that, you want to maintain your records such as your contracts, your service agreements, the activities undertaken, who owns the results of the research, and that should help you in that respect. Again, a lot of these will probably be in your project plans anyway, or should be. Okay, so expenditure incurred. An R&D entity can deduct expenditure incurs to the extent that the expenditure is incurred on one or more eligible R&D activities, and the expenditure, if the expenditure is incurred to an associate, it has to be paid. So again, you've got the expenditure side of things, which is, you know, your tax invoices, receipts, bank statements, that you actually, you know, spent that money, incurred that expenditure. You've got your record keeping in relation to your core R&D activities or your supporting R&D activities, and somewhere you need to make that connection that the expenditure is actually on those R&D activities. So it's up to the R&D entity to ensure that it has appropriate records to demonstrate that connection. So when it comes to the R&D offset claim, it's probably a good idea to have a breakdown of the expenses claimed and how each category relates to the registered R&D activities. So the R&D entity needs to correctly allocate the expenditure between eligible R&D activities and non-eligible activities. So apportionments that could apply to things like salary, the employees undertaking that work. So you might want to keep some time sheets, you know, job sheets, job descriptions, activities they do on particular days to show the time they actually spend on R&D activities versus normal business activities if you've got an employee who's doing like a dual role. Decline in value of assets. So if you've got assets or fixed assets that you use for dual purpose, you'll have to, you know, look at your fixed asset registers, depreciation schedules, look at the machine hours used, keep records of the machine hours used for both types of activities. Similarly, overhead expenses, you'll just need to keep records and make sure that they adequately explain your basis of apportionment. Clawbacks and feedstock, I won't go into that too much. Just remember that with the clawbacks, you know, if you're getting grants or recruitment monies received from government entities, they need to be included back in your assessable income. And you might be able to show that with grant applications, correspondence with government, payment dates, if there's several payments. Feedstock adjustments, again, just maybe keep your invoices relating to the sales of marketable products, working papers showing how you calculate the cost of producing the output and the cost of producing the marketable product. So the record keeping, this is some additional information that you can find on the website, on the ATO website and the business.gov.au website. It's actually quite comprehensive if you have, you know, if you need to use that. And we've got some R&D issues that are arising out of casework, fraudulent claims. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Advice from R&D consultants and intermediaries who are not registered or poor advice provided. As Brett has already mentioned, just seeing examples where either the tax agent maybe just doesn't understand, the R&D consultant maybe doesn't quite understand the provisions or has been providing cold calling and providing advice that is on the aggressive side. No nexus between the expenditure and the R&D activity, so where no R&D activity is undertaken at all or where the R&D has transitioned into business as usual expenses but they haven't made adjustments for that. Lack of substantiation, again, it's pretty self-explanatory. And other integrity measures not applied, and I'll just go through very quickly the public advice and guidance area. They have released a number of tax rulings and taxpayer alerts. That's just a small sample of them, and these are some areas of focus that they're working on now. I'm not aware of a timeline when they may be released, but they are in the works. So, yeah, thank you.
No, that's okay. I think we might have time for a couple of questions. I do have one that's come through, and it is, how does a commissioner have sufficient industry knowledge to make a call on whether expenditure is R&D in that space? Is it, do they hire experts? Do you ever consult with external parties?
That's a very good question. To this point in time, we haven't made, can I say, any, I'm going to use the Oz industry word, findings regarding eligibility. There's perhaps a nuance which might have been lost in my presentation is the Commissioner is not looking to himself proactively assert that that which an entity is doing meets the new knowledge requirement or whatever. What we did in GQHC was we put the taxpayer to proof, okay? So we allowed the tribunal to themselves make a decision as to whether or not the entity's registered activities were eligible. And also in that hearing itself, and it's within the judgment, we did instruct a industry expert in the poultry space who was well familiar. And so we certainly, in answer to that question, took advantage of external expertise.
Thank you. And I think Tom has a question.
Thank you very much, both of you, for the presentation. I'm just thinking that this GQHC actually is quite concerning, not from the perspective of R&D, but the concept of whether intensive livestock production is manufacturing. Now, this is particularly relevant in the context of closing stock, because obviously with normal livestock, we just value them at $20 or whatever the actual cost is. But you may remember back in about 1995, we had a draft tax determination in relation to whether we should use absorption costing or full absorption costing in relation to valuing, and Peter mentioned earlier, in relation to stock on hand, grain on hand. So the question is, how do we value? Now, if we are going to consider intensive livestock, so if we consider a vertically integrated livestock operation where we drop the calves, we grow them through to a feedlot to so that they are to mature as such, there may be an argument there, or a greater argument, that the Commissioner could now argue on the basis of this, is that intensive livestock is manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And if intensive livestock is manufacturing, well, then we apply full absorption. And, of course, if you apply full absorption costing, well, then the benefit of the deductions of the feed in the livestock, whether they're poultry or whether they're cattle, as such, that gets pulled back because, essentially, we increase the value of closing stock. I know that that has nothing to do with what Linda was talking about this morning, because that'll be statutory income as such. So that's one of the concerns that I have, Brett, and that's just an observation.
Yeah, look, I'll take that as an observation, but an interesting one and something I'll consider further. But, there probably are multiple takeaways from GQHC and... So I don't think this will be the last time we've heard of it.
Thank you. I'd like to thank both Brett Zimmerman and Ellen Lau for that presentation. Please remember to fill out your session evaluations at the attendee hub, and session number 10, Structuring and Restructuring the Family Farm, will begin shortly. Thank you. Thank you. I can't tell.